pública. El día de hoy hemos avanzado, se han liberado a los compañeros que estaban detenidos y pues vamos a seguir movilizándonos a partir de estos días para seguir evitando que nos apliquen la evaluación acá en Chiapas.
El resto de la entrevista con Alvarado puede escucharse o descargarse en nuestro blog pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com. En Palestina, un grupo de judíos penetró en masa el complejo de la mezquita Al-Aqsa en Jerusalén. Nur Harsin explica.
Medios de comunicación palestinos reportaron que docenas de colonos judíos irrumpieron en el complejo de la mezquita Al-Aqsa a través de la puerta encadenada para realizar sus oraciones. La incursión ocurrió luego de que grupos judíos de derecha hicieran un llamado a las autoridades israelíes para que permitieran visitas masivas a la mezquita durante la festividad judaica llamada Hanukkah. A primeras horas del día de hoy, tropas israelíes lanzaron una redada y una campaña de arrestos en varias casas palestinas, ubicadas en la ciudad de Nablus, al norte de Cisjordania. Fuentes palestinas han señalado que las fuerzas de ocupación arrestaron a 3 palestinos, quienes fueron acusados hace 2 meses de haber planificado un ataque en Itamar el pasado mes de octubre.
La antifada continúa. Nuestra batalla contra el enemigo israelí va a continuar hasta que alcancemos nuestros objetivos. No vamos a permitir que la antifada dure mucho, más de lo que debe hacerlo, ya que este levantamiento en Cisjordania tiene el objetivo de derrotar a las fuerzas de ocupación e impedir que los colonos israelíes entren en el complejo de la mezquita de Al-Aqsa. Eso es todo lo que necesitamos de esta antifada.
Por otra parte, 4 excavadoras israelíes invadieron las granjas de los residentes del campo de refugiados Al-Burray, ubicado en el centro de la franja de Gaza. Fuentes locales indicaron que las excavadoras allanaron las tierras y desde ellas se les disparó a las casas de los ciudadanos. Sin embargo, no se reportaron heridos. En otro lugar de Gaza, botes de la Armada israelí abrieron fuego este martes en la noche contra botes de pescadores palestinos que se encontraban mar adentro en la costa de Al-Sudaneya, ubicada al noroeste de la ciudad de Gaza. El vocero del Comité de Pescadores en la Franja de Gaza indicó que los pescadores se vieron obligados a huir inmediatamente del área a pesar de que se encontraban pescando dentro de la zona de pesca permitida de 6 millas náuticas. Nur Harasim, Telesur TV, Gaza.
En más noticias de Estados Unidos, políticos de diversas tendencias ideológicas están pidiendo que se bloquee la visita de Donald Trump a Israel. La respuesta del primer ministro Benjamin Netanyahu a tan airada petición es de que él está dispuesto a honrar la visita, pues ello no significa ningún apoyo para el controversial republicano. El encuentro de Netanyahu con Trump está programado para el 28 de diciembre de este año.
Esa voz gritará libertad, voy para allá. Si se trata de injusticia, esta voz gritará libertad, voy para allá. Se trata de injusticia. Vengo a masacrar, por supuesto, lirical a este maldito sistema que nos quiere asfixiar. Todo sigue subiendo y el alivio para el pobre nunca se ve llegar por necesidad. Gente buena ha tenido que robar, escogiendo el alimento, sus biles no pueden ya pagar. Se desliza una lágrima al estudio cantar.
En Estados Unidos, expertos legales aseguran que el llamado hecho por el precandidato presidencial republicano Donald Trump para prohibir la presencia de migrantes musulmanes no solo indigna a mucha gente, sino que viola las leyes nacionales. Entre estos expertos está Lawrence Tribe, profesor de leyes constitucionales en la Universidad de Harvard. Añade que además de presentar una gran dificultad para implementar ese tipo de prohibición, causaría un gran daño a la seguridad nacional de los Estados Unidos. Otros se preguntan cómo es que la prensa corporativa, virtualmente controlada por menos de una docena de empresas, continúa sirviendo como caja de resonancia para Donald Trump, sin cobrarle dinero por publicidad. Otros sugieren que ese racismo y xenofobia genera altos ratings para los medios, por tanto, las empresas siguen lucrando con la promoción del odio.
Que no dejan que el caso florezca. Este gobierno se lava la cara con lechuga fresca. Todo lo que hablan apesta y al pueblo cuesta. Que sean tan fequeros me molesta. Le disparo proyectiles con mi lírica como ballesta. ¿Quiénes son los bandidos? ¿Quiénes son los asesinos? El caso de Lorenzo no ha sido esclarecido. ¿Quiénes son los bandidos? Sino los que este pueblo han empobrecido. Nunca coman estiércol, yo pido.
En Francia, la cumbre sobre el cambio climático ya cuenta con un borrador del acuerdo definitivo, sin consenso en tres puntos básicos. Sergio Rodrigo nos explica desde la capital francesa.
Aquí en París ha presentado ya el primer borrador por parte de la presidencia de la COP21, es decir, de Francia, que ha presentado un nuevo texto en el que, de momento, van a seguir detallando los diferentes países. Son más de 190 las delegaciones que están presentes aquí en París debatiendo un texto, como digo, primer borrador en el que van a seguir debatiendo para que, según han señalado, posiblemente el viernes, según señalan fuentes cercanas a las negociaciones, haya un acuerdo legalmente vinculante para las partes. Según ha señalado la secretaria de las Naciones Unidas para esta cumbre del clima, Cristina Figueras, ha insistido en que el acuerdo ha estado prácticamente perfilado, que de momento habrá que esperar la votación de los distintos países sobre todos esos puntos, detalles que se van a ir incluyendo, y que confía en que finalmente ese acuerdo vinculante pueda llegar al final de esta 21 cumbre del clima que celebra París. De momento, también en un día en el que ha estado marcado no solo por las negociaciones de ese documento, un documento, como digo, está en modo borrador, donde los países van a seguir debatiéndolo, pero por otro lado, los movimientos sociales siguen insistiendo en un aspecto fundamental, y es que la financiación de esta cumbre del clima, el 20% ha estado en manos de grandes transnacionales. Se han exigido hoy, en un día marcada por la agricultura, donde los campesinos han participado aquí en París en diferentes marchas y conferencias, insistiendo en un aspecto fundamental, que esas grandes transnacionales no tengan más pesos que los campesinos que trabajan de manera tradicional las tierras ancestrales, en muchos casos donde viven comunidades indígenas. De momento, la actualidad en París destacó, parece que encamina un acuerdo legalmente vinculante según estas fuentes, y que de momento, con ese borrador, los países van a seguir trabajando para acelerar un acuerdo para final de semana.
La presidenta de Argentina, Cristina Fernández, concluyó su gestión el miércoles, dejando entre millones de sus compatriotas el sabor del éxito, ya que sus logros dejan una huella profunda en la historia del país sudamericano. Pepe Frutos, del Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias, preparó el siguiente reporte.
En estos 12 años se alcanzaron importantes logros que comenzaron en el año 2003, con, por ejemplo, una medida importante como fue la modificación de la composición de la Corte Suprema, con el nombramiento de nuevos integrantes elegidos entre los más prestigiosos juristas del país. También se comenzaron y sostuvieron hasta nuestros días los juicios por los crímenes de la última dictadura, se saldó la deuda con el Fondo Monetario Internacional y se impidió que ese organismo siguiera teniendo injerencia en la política nacional. Además, se nacionalizaron empresas como la de agua y cloacas en la capital federal y en Gran Buenos Aires, el Correo Argentino, Aerolíneas Argentinas, YPF y Ferrocarriles Argentinos. Además, se recuperaron por ley los fondos de las jubilaciones que estaban en manos de grandes empresas privadas.
Si pensamos en la Constitución, en esa Constitución que dice que es el Estado el que debe garantizar las jubilaciones y las pensiones de los argentinos. Pero yo les propongo otra hipótesis. Supongamos que esta presidenta, supongamos que ese administrador, piensan en la caja. ¿En qué caja pensamos? En la del ANSES. Yo pregunto a los que quieren seguir con el sistema de las AFJP, ¿a qué caja defienden o a qué caja quieren representar?
Y la recuperación de los fondos previsionales permitió la incorporación de millones de nuevos jubilados, también la ley de movilidad jubilatoria, que estableció dos aumentos para los jubilados por año, y medidas en beneficio de los desocupados y de sus hijos, como por ejemplo la asignación universal por hijo. También durante estos 12 años se recuperaron las paritarias anuales para que empresarios, sindicatos y el Ministerio de Trabajo puedan discutir salarios. Además, en octubre de 2009 se aprobó la Ley de Servicios de Comunicación Audiovisual, la Ley de Radio y Televisión de la Democracia.
Es el triunfo del pueblo que con su unidad venció a los monstruos, venció a los grupos económicos más poderosos de este país, haciendo posible que las instituciones democráticas nos dieran una ley surgida del debate de la democracia. Esta ley es la ley que hicimos, que construimos todos en las calles, en los sindicatos, en las universidades públicas, en las escuelas. Es la ley que hicimos con las madres y con las abuelas de Plaza de Mayo.
Y entre otros logros del kirchnerismo en estos 12 años, se aprobó la ley a favor de las trabajadoras de casas particulares, que consiguieron que les sean reconocidos los mismos derechos que el resto de los trabajadores. También se aprobó, luego de más de 100 años, un nuevo Código Civil y Comercial. Hubo una ley a favor de los trabajadores rurales, que recuperaron derechos. También se aprobó la Ley de Identidad de Género y la Ley de Matrimonio Igualitario.
Que yo el otro día, de una sanción tan importante de una ley, me había levantado exactamente con los mismos derechos que había tenido antes de la sanción. Cosa rara, ¿no? Porque cada vez que se aprueban cosas importantes, alguno queda siempre tambaleando con algo menos, o por lo menos es la historia de la Argentina, ¿no? Y del mundo. Y sin embargo, yo estaba con los mismos derechos y había cientos de miles que habían conquistado los mismos derechos que yo tenía. Por eso me sentí... Nadie me había sacado nada. Y yo no le había sacado nada a nadie. Al contrario, le habíamos dado a otros cosas que le faltaban y que nosotros teníamos. Por eso digo que somos una sociedad un poco más igual.
La convocatoria para despedir a la presidenta Cristina Fernández será esta tarde en la Plaza de Mayo, y el acto en el que se va a descubrir un busto del expresidente Néstor Kirchner en la Casa de Gobierno está convocado para las 18. La presidenta Cristina Fernández no estará en la asunción de Mauricio Macri como nuevo presidente. El jefe de la Agencia Federal de Inteligencia, Oscar Parrilli, y el secretario general de la presidencia, Eduardo De Pedro, explicaron que no están dadas las condiciones, ya que el macrismo recurrió a la justicia y el fiscal federal Jorge Di Lello dictaminó que el mandato de Cristina Fernández finaliza hoy a las 24.
Ante este dictamen del fiscal, de que dice que el mandato termina a las 12 horas del día, a las 0 horas del día 10 o a las 24 horas del día 9, la presidenta no puede concurrir 12 horas después a hacer entrega de un mandato presidencial cuando hay un fiscal que ha determinado de que ya su función ha concluido. Por lo tanto, esperen. Por lo tanto, para no ser sometida nuevamente a una acusación de este fiscal o cualquier otro de que puede hacer usurpación de títulos viniendo a las 12 en su calidad de presidenta, y además porque no es su intención de ninguna manera entorpecer, ni ridiculizar, ni menospreciar, ni menoscabar el acto institucional que significa la asunción del nuevo presidente. Por lo tanto, en estas condiciones, no están dadas las condiciones para que la presidenta concurra al Congreso el día 10 de diciembre, cuando tome juramento el nuevo presidente.
Recordemos que la falta de acuerdo se dio porque Macri pretendía recibir la banda presidencial en la Casa Rosada y la presidenta quería entregársela en el Congreso inmediatamente después de la jura como nuevo presidente. La Constitución Nacional no habla sobre el traspaso de los atributos como la banda y el bastón presidencial, pero sí dice que la jura debe ser ante la Asamblea Legislativa, ante el Congreso Nacional. Incluso el propio Macri dijo 2 días después de ganar el balotaje que había acordado con la presidenta que el traspaso se haría en el Congreso como corresponde, había dicho.
Ese reporte fue preparado por Pepe Frutos del Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias, FARCO. Y aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Toste y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. Seize the airwaves.
Paul, it's an honor to speak with you today. Tell me a little about yourself and your interest in the issue of homelessness. How did you get involved?
Basically, through a process of ending up kind of bouncing around from place to place. This was the late 70s, early 80s. We didn't have the tag homelessness yet. We didn't have a homeless problem yet. We just had more and more of us that were finding themselves with nowhere to live on a permanent basis. And living off of sisters, living off of friends, squatting. Went to Europe through a woman I met. Ended up hanging out at squats in Amsterdam and Copenhagen, came back to New York. There was all the Avenue A, B, C stuff going on with the squats down there. And decided to come out to San Francisco. And through the good graces of one of my sisters, was able to get out here. And got involved with Hospitality House in January of 83. San Francisco started its homeless program in October of 82 and have been doing this stuff every day since then.
So looking back over the last 50 to 75 years, we have seen a huge shift in the number and visibility of homeless people in this country. Walk me through what happened and how we got to where we are today.
Well, when you actually go back and look at it from a cause and effect systemic perspective, instead of looking at, well, what drugs were available or deinstitutionalization or like, but something clearly happened shortly before October of 82, because New York City started opening shelters in 81 and police stations, empty police stations were the first shelters in New York City. Here in San Francisco, it was empty muni buses that they put out in front of St. Anthony's and in front of the old welfare department. And everything was temporary, short-term, crisis, you know. But yet no one really seemed to stop and look and say, what's creating it? And when we did that, when I was even still at the coalition, so maybe 15, 17 years ago, we, working off of a report that Cushing Dolbrer, when she was still running the National Low Income Housing Coalition, had done, where we didn't ever really bunch of GED from the street dudes. I'll speak for myself. I didn't understand it. And the data that was flowing out of D.C. was a little bit over our heads. And it was like we couldn't use it if we couldn't understand it. It didn't really serve as an organizing tool for us until we pulled out public housing, Section 8, the programs that we knew that we all hung out with, and looked at those funding trends and looked at those charts and then started digging deep into exactly when the cuts came, who was the president at the time, what was appropriated versus what was allocated or whatever. And it showed so clearly that from 1979 to 1983, in 2004 constant dollars, $54 billion a year in affordable housing funding was cut by the federal government. So when you have this cumulative series of cuts that equals $54 billion a year, that then expands it and carries out at $54 billion a year over the next 25, 30 years, you ain't going to do nothing but create homelessness for people that are poor. And so that became a strong organizing tool for rap especially, because we're in all these different cities. So what are the common threads that we all have that connect us as one? And federal funding for affordable housing should be a connecting issue for every poverty-based organization, every social justice-based organization. And I say social justice because over that same period of time, the homeowner mortgage interest deduction program tripled. So it wasn't that the Fed stopped spending money on housing. It was that the Feds reprioritized who benefits from federal largesse in accessing housing. And it clearly went from poor people to home ownership programs, because home ownership programs benefit mortgage companies, realtors, and home builders associations more than it benefits anybody else. And so that became a priority.
So was it just the financial sector that was primarily responsible for this shift, or were there philosophical and political reasons for the shift in funding as well?
The best that I'm able to really speak to with any like sense of confidence in terms of what these guys was thinking, and they were overwhelmingly guys, is Carter in 79 seemed to do this across the board series of cuts. And in looking at the numbers, it was across the board. There was a recession at the time. There was also a gas crisis. There was also the Iran hostages, but there was a recession at the time. Reagan's revolution was taking neoliberal economic policies and making them the bedrock of the United States government. We had tested that stuff for years in Central America and South America. Banana Republic refers to Chiquita Banana Company. So companies ran governments, and governments served companies. And that was tested and played with and tweaked, and people were killed and whatever. Reagan's revolution at its core was commodifying every single priority for the federal government. If it wasn't making money for somebody somewhere in the private market, it had no value to the United States government. The United States government first and foremost priority, and we see that now in our military, we see it in our prisons, we see it in our jails, we see it in our health care, we see it in our education, we see it in our housing policy, we see it everywhere. Our public parks are about commodities and about generating revenue for private corporate interest. And if it ain't, whatever it is, if it ain't doing that, then it's not a funding priority. It merits, it's not economic stimulus, and therefore it merits no support, whether it be through tax credits or whether it be through direct funding from our federal government. And the end result of that is people that don't have money ain't getting nothing except more policing, more private security, more jails, and more prisons. And that we seem to be getting ad nauseum.
Was that HUD change in funding priorities related to the reduction in the number of rural affordable housing units constructed, or was there something different going on with that?
No, it was when rural housing funding was created, it was during the New Deal. When HUD, what is now called HUD, was created, it was 1937. So when you think back to the New Deal era, to administer housing funding for local communities, you already had a U.S. Department of Agriculture that was in rural communities. So there was no need to create a new federal government program to administer that funding. You did it through the apparatus that was already there. So USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as weird as it may sound to some people, has since the 1930s funded affordable housing and home ownership programs in rural communities. HUD was created in 1937 specifically around urban development programs. And a lot of it had to do with the health issues and the tenement housings that existed. And if somebody got a cold, the whole building ended up with pneumonia and hep C and tuberculosis. And so that's why we all have air wells in our SRO buildings and stuff. Was there was a big, strong health aspect to meriting federal funding for affordable housing development. So they couple each other just based solely on the economic principles of federal funding does not go to support activities and programs and community efforts that are not generating revenue for corporate America. Bottom line, I mean, there's no other, it's so universal, it's so across the board that it was obviously a priority to say, a policy. You can see it being implemented in different programs as its life expands. And it's all over the place now. We're mortgaging off public housing. Like, how much more of a commodification statement can you make than to start literally mortgaging off public housing that was created with U.S. tax dollars for the sole purpose of ensuring safe, decent, affordable housing for every American?
So what federal programs have replaced the policy of building and maintaining affordable housing?
As any federal or state or local, as they start deciding to defund an activity or a program, is you always create a smaller version, a cheaper micro version of whatever that program was. So as they have decided to stop funding public housing, which they decided years ago in both maintenance and upkeep and new development and Hope 6 and destroying units and increasing rents, as they started implementing those decisions, there's always a strong necessity to pretend like you're still doing something about the lives of the people that you're screwing over. And so you see it so much in mental health. Like, as residential treatment, which was the solution to the institutionalization, it wasn't putting people on the street and in jail. That was the recommended solution to that. As that got dismantled, all of these little quasi, little semi, innocuous little programs started popping up all over the place. And all funded by the state. You know, in that case, because the state was the ones making the deepest cuts. You know, in housing, they're now funding homeless programs. They know goddamn well, since they passed McKinney in 1987, that homeless programs are being created because we're cutting affordable housing. That was in all of the testimony. It was in all of the justification for Reagan, of all presidents, to sign the McKinney Act. Everybody at the table knew that this was a response to the cuts to affordable housing. And now it's the answer to homelessness. What? It wasn't a lack of homeless programs that created homelessness. It was a decimation and the demolition and the selling off of and the defunding of our housing programs that created homelessness, and now our homeless programs are talking about housing first with no freaking housing money. Are redefining when a person is homeless versus when they're poorly housed so that they can say, we're not turning away homeless people. These people don't qualify for homeless services. Like, it's a freaking welfare program. You don't qualify for these services? What the hell? If you're desperate enough to walk up to a shelter and ask for a place to sleep, who gives a damn whether or not you qualify? You must be in pretty bad freaking shape, especially if you got your kids in tow. And it was the youth and the kids that they are abusing the most with this redefinition, because they want to focus on single adults. They want to focus on the most visible. And this whole funding stream and technical assistance and National Alliance to End Homelessness and Corporation for Supportive Housing and this whole industry gets created around a pretense of addressing the issues that make up the lives of the people that live in our communities. In order to justify the neoliberal economic policies that actually drive the decision-making process of the United States government. And it's time to call them on this.
Can you describe one or two of these recent federal programs used to address the homeless issue and explain why they never seem to get the traction they need in homelessness?
Well, the most obvious target these days is Housing First, which is the one that everybody's hearing about, which is the one that when you actually go to look at HUD and look at the federal government's budget and look for the funding stream and the line item, because in the blue book of the federal government is a line item for every single dollar they spend or allocate. There's no line item for Housing First. Housing First was created in the public relations office. It wasn't created in the funding office. And if we really were serious about Housing First, we would obviously, of course, restore the funding for housing. How the hell can you do Housing First without any housing? So it just begs itself to the ridiculousness and the lack of depth connected to social policy and public policy issues in the mainstream media that you see, and even from the lefty mainstream media. You see all these articles in The Nation and about, oh, how great Housing First is. And in fact, what they're looking at is the Chronic Homeless Initiative, which is single adults only, if you've been homeless for a certain period of time, and in old buildings that used to house poor people. These are not new construction. So you take an SRO building in a low-income neighborhood, you kick a bunch of poor people out of it, you rehab it, you reopen it as a new housing initiative for homeless people, and you put all of your funding and all of your priorities geared towards the chronic homeless single adult for one reason and one reason only, because they are the most visible. And so in rural communities and in every community where, you know, we have massive numbers, we have 1.2 million kids that go to school every day that don't have a home to go to that night. But our number one priority is the visible single adult. And then we wonder why the numbers of families keep growing and the numbers of you know, teenage suicides and abuse and beatings of homeless people, you know, continues to just get worse and worse and worse, because people are being told one thing, the reality is something completely different. The days of women and children first are long freaking gone. If HUD had been driving the Titanic, the life rafts would have only been filled with single adults, so you could say you saved more people. And it's a recipe for disaster, and it's blowing up in their face. The other program is point-in-time headcounts. If you really gave a how many people are homeless in America at any given time or over the course of a year, having local communities spend millions and millions of dollars to hire consultants and trainers and staff and vests and flashlights and write reports and do all this, because they love to study poverty, they love to study racism, they love to study homelessness, because they don't have any intention of addressing any of those issues. But if you really did give a January 25th, once every 2 years, go out and count people sleeping in the streets, like, how more blatant and obvious could the pretentiousness behind this possibly be? There is no legitimate interest or intent to get actual numbers. There's a legitimate interest and intent to make it look like you give a shit and you want to get numbers. But there is no intent to get numbers that are going to have any meaningful guidance in setting priorities about what's happening in the local community. And this is national. Like, January 25th in Bozeman, Montana, in Detroit, Michigan, in Chicago, in New York, in Portland, Oregon. You know, January 25th tends to be pretty freaking cold. So to think that going out and counting the numbers of heads of people that you see sleeping in the streets on that night, and the most amazing part is those numbers that come out from that process are now the official numbers. Just like Reagan did with unemployment. When the unemployment numbers were getting too high, Reagan's people said, well, from now on, the only people that count as unemployed are in employment programs or getting unemployment benefits. Otherwise, we no longer count those people as being unemployed. And voila, the numbers of people in America went way down that were unemployed. And that's the number we use today. That's still, when they talk about 7.9% unemployment or 9.2% unemployment or the unemployment numbers or this or that, it's based on that formula. It's not people with no job. It's people that are not in those programs. That's exactly what the point in time headcount is for looking at homelessness in America today.
We're always hearing, mostly from right-wing politicians and Fox News, that we need to reduce the size of government within our budget. This is often used as an argument for why money is not available to address issues like universal health care, education, and the effort to end homelessness. What is your take on that argument?
I don't think it's that we're hearing it now from right-wing politicians and Fox News. You go back and look at Reagan's speeches leading up to his presidency and the whole time while he was president, and then pretty much every single president except maybe Carter, he was before Reagan, so pretty much every single president since then. Government is bad, business is good. You look at neoliberal economic policy and writings, government is bad, business is good. It is the Reagan Revolution. That's what we live under. It's what we've been living under in a progressive state of takeover. You know, business is our people now. According to our Supreme Court, you know, according to the ultimate law of the land, businesses are people, and they deserve the attention and access and political clout that supposedly goes to people if you can afford to pay for it. So this, you know, Fox News is an offshoot of that. Like anytime, even if you're talking about a local organizing campaign, you create a mission statement. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? You set your goals and objectives, and you lay out your working plan. Don't think that's not what we're up against. Business improvement districts are freaking evil, but it doesn't make them stupid. And also what I've noticed is when you look at the corporate agenda and when you look at the takeover of a country agenda that we're up against, it's long term. They're not thinking 3 to 5. I mean, they are thinking 3 to 5 years. They have a work plan over the next 3 to 5 years, but their goals and objectives are way longer than that. And the Supreme Court decision was one step in that process. Getting Reagan elected was the first step in that process, convincing everybody. And the fact that Democrats are so lame in their defense of what it would be called social programs, and they don't want to say socialism, they don't want to say we have a social agenda, we have a social issue, there's no social justice, because somehow that's bad. Like, why wouldn't the United States government want a socially just governance structure? Why wouldn't the government want people to be educated, to be healthy, to be housed? And if they really wanted to support a capitalist system, to have some freaking money in their pocket. Like, why is that considered bad? It's been considered bad because it's been beaten into the heads of all of us for the last 35 years that government bad, business good. So now our downtowns, our public-private partnerships, our parks are public-private partnerships. Our public housing is now going to be a public-private partnership. our military. It just goes on and on and on. That there is no legitimate role that government plays in the lives of the people that we govern, because the only ones that can do it is private industry.
You are listening to KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno. This is Mike Rhodes, and you're listening to an interview with Paul Bowden. Paul is with the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and he's just finished publishing a book, House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco and Beyond. Sometimes, rather than addressing the root causes of homelessness, cities pass quality of life laws to stop homeless people from sleeping or sitting in public, asking for money, pushing shopping carts, etc. What do you think is motivating this criminalization of poverty?
You know, we often use in our organizing a poster from 1936 that was put out by the mayor of New York, funded by the WPA. Hired a local artist, and there's all these images in the middle of the poster of poverty and homelessness, and on the top of it it says, "Must we always have this?" with a giant question mark. And then at the bottom it says, "Why not housing?" You would never see that today. We've pitched it to everybody that's run for mayor in San Francisco, anybody that's running for mayor that's willing to talk to us, or any other office. Like, why is local mayors and state elected officials and state departments allowing the federal government to just pull out and get the hell out of the social issues of people's lives, the health care, the education, the housing issues of people's lives? Why are they allowing that to happen? And why are we electing people that allow that to happen? So giving a tax break to Twitter to take over a building in a quasi-low income neighborhood. San Francisco doesn't have a whole lot of low-income neighborhoods left, but in a quasi-area of low income, in addition to all the tax breaks that Twitter's already getting for being in California from the state, for being Twitter from the feds. I mean, my God, and the tax breaks that you get as a business. My Jesus, lunch, luxury boxes, football games, baseball games, whatever. You know, like, we're already giving massive breaks to these guys. And yet the local government is now also on local taxes. And yet local government's looking at thousands of people sleeping in its streets. Well, how are you going to deal with that? You're going to use your jails. You're going to use your courts. You're going to create laws that say it's illegal to sit down in public space. Everybody's going to sit down in public space. You know that. I know that. They know that. Everybody knows that. Everybody's going to stand still. Everybody's going to lay down. Everybody at some point in time, whether they like it or not, is going to go to sleep. Everybody is going to have to eat at some point in time. So we're passing all these laws that make sitting, standing, sitting, sleeping, laying down, closing our public parks, making it illegal to eat, making it illegal to serve food so people can eat. And everybody in the game knows, just like with Jim Crow laws, just like with sundown towns, just like with Antioquia laws, everybody in the process knows this is about certain people. This isn't. These are laws that are universal. They're a law. But the application of these laws is about certain people. And it's been Japanese Americans, it's been African Americans, it's been mentally ill people, it's been homeless people, and today again it's homeless people. But this has been done against other people. Bostarero treaties. It was about Mexicans, you know, people from Mexico. So, like, you know, everybody in the process knows. And so local businesses push the creation of local laws that are passed by local government, that are signed by local mayors, that are enforced by local police and local private security companies, that are adjudicated in local courts and people are incarcerated in local jails. It stays in the family. And they can do it. They have the legal authority to put in law time, place, and manner restrictions in local communities and public space. So they have the authority, they have the ability, they have the desire, they have the will, and apparently, because the one thing that every mayor always tells me is, I can get police money. I can't get no housing money. I can't get no education money. I can't get no healthcare money. But I can get money for cops. And now the freaking Pentagon, well, not now, this has been going on for a while, but the Pentagon will give you unused military equipment as well. You know, when they busted the squats in the Lower East Side back in the late 70s, it was the first time the Pentagon had given unused or unwanted military equipment to a local police department. And they actually showed up in these little armored personnel carriers when they were busting those squats. Eric Drucker was doing a thing at the Howard Zinn Fair the other day and had pictures of it because he lived there. So again, none of this is new. You know, anti-Oki laws and sundown towns and Jim Crow and ugly laws for, you know, this is not new. It's history repeating itself, because while we overturned Jim Crow, while we overturned anti-Oki, we didn't take away the ability for local governments to enforce and to create and enforce blatantly racist and classist legal legislation.
Maybe a better question is, what can be done to stop this criminalization of the homeless?
Well, our attempt, you know, what we're going for right now, based on 1,300, actually now it's closer to 1,700 interviews that we did with people in the streets, you know, those things I mentioned, the sitting, standing, you know, eating, sleeping, laying down, these are the top three criminal offenses that homeless people of the 1,700 that we've spoken to, and this is by far and away the top three, is sleeping, standing, and sitting. Like, those are illegal acts if you're perceived to be of a certain class. And so we're pushing legislation in Oregon and California, working with a lot of groups in Colorado, working with groups now on a campaign in Washington that says local governments cannot criminalize the act of sleeping in a vehicle so long as it's legally parked, sitting, standing, laying down, eating, or sharing food. Like, that those are protected acts. Those are not, cannot be criminalized anymore in the future. Because those are acts that get criminalized that you know everyone's gonna violate. And so the fact that we have historically allowed local governments to pass laws to make it illegal to sleep, or to sit, or to stand still, you know everyone's going to do that. So our bill says you can't make those illegal activities anymore. Basically, under the assumption that if we build power, if we keep working on this, because I don't think these bills are going to be easy, but nothing worthwhile is, and they lose the ability to get rid of us and make us disappear, our right to exist gives us power. And if you can't say, go away, disappear, I'm closing my eyes, I don't want to see you anymore. If you can no longer do that to us, then maybe as human beings, you're going to have to start talking to us. And you're going to have to start dealing with us as human beings. And as people with rights. And that I live here, I have a right to be here. And we need to figure out how we're going to work together. Because you no longer have the legal authority to make me disappear.
In addition to the homeless Bill of Rights work, what other efforts are you working on to stop attacks against the homeless and return enough funding for affordable housing to end homelessness?
To be honest, I mean, I think one is we need to get a hell of a lot more accountable in who our reps are. You know, we're poor people, homeless people, whatever. Like, we're being repped by professionals. And there's a whole industry. And this is the legacy of the war on poverty, is with 501c3s, of which RAP is one. Foundation, charitable giving, IRS codes. There's so little passion and so little visceral connection when you get to City Hall and then you get to the state and then you get to the federal level. The professionalization of who is repping poor people is disgusting. And I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. We're obviously a part of that system. So, but we do street outreach and we do our community forums as an attempt to say this is who we're representing. So the 1,300 that we have documented, the 1,700 that we've talked to, that sets our priorities. And as organizers and as reps, we have no ability to change that. So we can't cut a deal on the Homeless Bill of Rights campaign that doesn't mirror the priorities that were set from the street outreach and the community forums we did. We can't do that just by the structure that we set up. I'm telling you, man, like, you get into D.C., you get into Sacramento, you get into City Hall, that's not standard operating procedure for those that are in there repping poor people. So then local politicians, state politicians, national politicians get certificates and awards and plaques and honored at dinner because they can bring in money to the organization. They get technical assistance grants to implement policies that, damn, wait a second, I thought you opposed Hope 6. And now you're building a Hope 6 program? How did that happen? That kind of short-sighted, self-serving representation of poverty and class and racism in this country has to stop. And the only way it's going to stop is if the National Alliance to End Homelessness holds a conference and nobody shows up. Because nobody wants to hear what they got to say. And I'm telling you, that ain't going to happen anytime soon. Their conference gets thousands of people. Because if you want HUD funding, you want to be in good with the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Like, that's just how the game is played. And so to think that those guys are actually repping with passion and conviction the issues of poor and homeless people in their community, that they're not opposing Feinstein's Homeless Children and Youth Act, which would get rid of the redefining family homelessness and youth homelessness so that any family that says I'm homeless is considered homeless. They're opposing it and calling people poorly housed. So now we have a new category of homeless families. There's homeless families, and then there's poorly housed families. And then there's, just like with low income, and then there's extremely low income and extremely, or hunger, where now there's all of these categories of hunger. All these categories of poor, all these categories of homeless. Somebody's benefiting within each of those category areas. Like, those things don't just happen on their own. And they happen because we let it happen. And we let other people define us. We let poverty pimps pimp off us. We let politicians use us and fund us and then defund us when we piss them off. We allow that to happen. And until we decide to stop allowing that to happen, it's going to continue to happen. And I think by the time you get to the point where you're freaking homeless, what else are they going to do? What do you got to lose? You're homeless. So when you start fighting back at that level, Anything, the fact that we even have a punk little office is a hell of a lot more than we had when we started. And we got nothing to lose. Because the very worst that can happen is we end up back where we were when we started in the first place, and that is just the way it is. But I don't think most organizers or organizations repping communities understand the power inherent in that statement, that you have to organize like you got nothing to lose, so you just tell the truth. And if you tell the truth, you never have to remember what you said, and you can just keep saying it. I was just, because the street sheet turned 25 years old in a couple of months, turns 25 in a couple of months. I was looking at a video that was done about the street sheet in 1992. It was amazing. The things that people were saying are exactly the things that we're saying today. And somebody said, wow, that's too bad. And I was like, I don't think so, because we haven't won yet. And the fact that it's different, not totally different people. It was cool to see how many were still around. But several had died and several had moved on. But they were talking the same smack we're talking today, and with the same spirit and with the same accountability, that we're talking today. And I think, you know, that's an amazing testament 25 years later. That it is that ingrained. Everybody uses their own words, but the spirit and the intent and the accountability behind what was being said is exactly the same thing that we're saying today.
Paul, you've just written a book, House Keys, Not Handcuffs. Tell me what the book is about.
It's about, and actually the full title of the book is House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco and Beyond. Because the book is about, after 30 years, there was like an idea of doing an art book and honoring my 30 years, blah, blah, blah. And it just didn't feel right. And so Art Hazelwood, Bob Prentice, a bunch of other people got together, and this is a collection of essays. It's three essays, one long-winded one from me about the last 30 years of organizing in San Francisco and what we were trying to accomplish and why we did the stuff that we did at the Homeless Coalition, at Hospitality House and in other places. And also, like, as serving as, when we started in the early 80s coming out of Hospitality House, me and my friends, like, we knew that we weren't doing something new. But there was all these people that wanted to train us and tell us, and how many copies of Rules for Radicals I received back in them days. It could have built us a house. But they weren't talking to us the way that I'm hoping this comes across to people that are thinking about doing stuff. This speaks from the heart to the heart. How you do it, that's your stuff. There's no, you know, Robert's Rules of Order and all that. People don't need to hear that. People get involved in doing organizing work from their heart. And so to reinforce that and to validate that and to give warnings about the power of money and how you deal with money before you have it, so that when it does come, it doesn't take over you, but you control it. You know, the power of accountability, the ability to say we. You know, my first comment when somebody comes to me and says, we think this, is who's we? I only see you. Show me your street outreach. Show me what you've done. Validate who we is before you start saying the homeless this or you know, like whatever whoever you're repping. And also the power of, don't think you're going to win. Like, you know, on the back we have a photo of a direct action, you know, and the quote on it is, it's not important whether you win or lose. It's important that you put up the fight and that you are willing to stand for something and fight for it, and that you're willing to lick your wounds and fight again tomorrow. That's what's important. That's 10 times more important than did I win? Because if you keep doing that, eventually you will win. If what's important about the fight is winning the fight, then get into boxing or play football or play a game. But in social policy and in social justice campaigns, winning the fight isn't the issue. Fighting the fight is the issue. And sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. That's how it goes. Mostly you lose. Certainly on homeless stuff, mostly you lose. But that's not the priority. The priority is that you were willing to fight. And so that's what the first essay is about. The second essay is about how artwork plays such a vital role in that. And there's 67 images in the book, because everything rap touches is about art as our voice, as our messaging tool. And how we've used and learned, and gotten better at creating and using artwork over the years as part of an organizing and public education campaign. And then the third essay is from an awesome dude named Bob Prentice, who was the first homeless czar in San Francisco back in Feinstein's era, or Agnos. I think he was in Agnos's era. And how it was perceived and how it played out and how it looked and how he was able to support and how important it was to have a non-government funded, no holds barred, unafraid, relentless organizing campaign so that he could, on the inside of government, use that to advance more humane policies and more humane programming. So it's an interesting way of giving different perspectives and not claiming to give a history lesson, because I couldn't remember everyone's name. I couldn't remember every group that was involved. It's like, we say in the book, the first lesson of this book is, if you want to write a book like this, start documenting your stuff in the beginning. Because going back 30 years later and thinking you're giving a history lesson is just BS. You ain't. You're giving a perspective. And so, without any fear or hesitation, is the spirit behind what we were doing and how we held ourselves accountable.
In your experience, what organizing models work best to build a movement to protect homeless people's rights and shift priorities at the national level so there's enough affordable housing to end homelessness?
Well, and as soon as we get to that point, I'll let you know what organizing methodology we used, because I can speak to the one that we're using now, which is about creating 133 organizations in 5 states that are all working together to try to do some kick-ass stuff. It hasn't protected people's rights at this point, and it hasn't restored affordable housing funding. So I wish, and what I love about with both working now with Colorado and Washington, is their first thing they're doing is street outreach. I think that's vital. I think if you were a union organizer on a plant and you had never talked to anybody in that plant, you probably would not be seen as all that good of a union organizer. I hate when I hear homeless organizers talking about, well, you just can't motivate people. It's like, really? That's not been my experience. It's what are you asking people to do in order to be involved? Because everybody likes to be involved in something bigger than themselves. Everybody likes it, whether they're homeless or not. And, the other point would be, I don't care if you've been homeless. If you're doing street outreach and you're documenting what homeless people say and then we're going through those responses and we're putting them into our forms, it doesn't matter if you've been homeless or not, because you ain't repping homeless people. The people you spoke to are repping homeless people. And I think this whole leadership, I used to write in all of our grants anti-leadership training, and none of the foundations would fund it. Finally, one of the staff people was like, Paul, leave the program exactly how you have it. Just stop calling it that. But my point was, homeless people and poor people got way too many freaking leaders as it is. What they don't have is somebody to clean the bathroom, somebody to dig the trench and actually create a foundation so that we can build off of that foundation. And I think the best organizing, the cleanest organizing, the most helpful long-term organizing is to be a laborer to the movement, not a leader of the movement. And then I think you start seeing progress. And again, going back to that whole corporate neoliberal thinking long term. And if you think you're going to start doing this and you're going to be the next Martin Luther King didn't create the movement. The movement created Martin Luther King. Malcolm X didn't create Islam. You know, like these guys didn't create these movements. These movements created these guys. And you got to think of it that way. And you have to say, my job in this is to be digging the trench and making sure the walls don't fall in and making sure that when we pour the concrete, it's going to settle right and it's going to work. So the next generation can lay the flooring. The next generation can put up the walls. And by the end of the process, people will live in a really beautiful house. But if no one lays the foundation and pours the, and digs the ditch, that house is never going to be worth standing. You're never going to, you know. Mitch Snyder didn't end homelessness. Like, get over it. And stop looking for a freaking leader. And start looking for laborers. And if you're looking for laborers, you know, we're 133 organizations that are digging ditches. And so you can just join us.
You have been listening to an interview with Paul Bowden. Paul is the executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project in San Francisco. For more information about RAP and how to connect with them, you can visit their website at www.raphome.org.
Hey, this is Emily from the Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You can hear this show every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock right here on 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. This program is dedicated to exploring social change and spirituality, compassion, and anarchism. Free Radio Santa Cruz is collectively run and has been operating without a license from the U.S. government since 1995. And my very special guest here in the studio this evening, right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, is Keith McHenry. And Keith helped to found Food Not Bombs, which is quite a huge conglomeration of independent organizations around the world now. It's pretty amazing how it's spread. He started it in 1980 in Massachusetts. He was born in Frankfurt, West Germany in 1957. Like I said, Food Not Bombs started in 1980. By 1988, there was a second chapter of FNB in California. He has spent quite a bit of time in jail. We'll hear a little about that. Due to the fact that it is illegal in a lot of places in this country and around the world to offer free food to people that are hungry. I said that out loud this evening at my home, and my six-year-old looked at me with confused eyes and had some questions about, did you just say that people go to jail for feeding other people? So we'll be having conversations about that in my home. Keith has helped to feed people after Hurricane Katrina, and he's suffered at the hands of police quite regularly, too. Keith McHenry, I'm really happy that you're here. Thanks for making time to be here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's exciting. It's so cool.
Tell me about the original vision that you had with Food Not Bombs. Where did the inspiration come from, and how did that first start?
Well, there were sort of three little stories, which many listeners may have heard bits of in past lectures. But one is I was studying painting and sculpture at Boston University, and one of my professors was Professor Howard Zinn in my American history class. And so I started going to these protests against Seabrook Nuclear Power Station, and a friend got arrested. Brian Feigenbaum, and we started raising money for his legal defense by doing these bake sales. And also at the same time, I had a little moving company called Smooth Move, and we were moving this family, and the family had a sign that said, wouldn't it be a beautiful day if the schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. And that gave us kind of the an idea for a type of street theater where we brought the food out for this bake sale. We would dress up as military personnel from getting uniforms at the Army Navy surplus store. And people, of course, didn't believe us. And we'd have our little sign there saying, like, how, you know, that you know, we're doing a bake sale to buy a bomber and stuff like that. And it was really inspiring. So that was one of the ideas. And, you know, Reagan got elected around that time. He was running for office, and I lived with in a collective house in Somerville. And we, a lot of, there was like half the house was liberal Democrats and half the house was anarchist. And the anarchists were like, oh yeah, he won the election. Who cares? Let's go out and do graffiti. And so we like, well, at first we thought, well, he's going to nuke us all. You know, why don't we do LSD to the end of the world? And we'll just run around graffitiing things and you know, while tripping. And then about like, you know, 10 in the morning, we're like, oh my God, we can't trip to the end of the world. This is just going to be taken. You know, wonder if he doesn't nuke us right away. Things are we're gonna be burned out. So so at breakfast we decided we would do something more practical. And one of the things I'd already been doing is collecting produce from Bread and Circus, where I worked, a natural food store that's like Whole Foods, and I'd take the food down to the projects. And the projects were on Portland Avenue. And one day I'm talking to the people there, like, what's these brand new building they're building across the street? And they're like, oh, we hear they're going to make a nuclear, there's a place to design nuclear weapons. And it ended up, it was a Draper Lab, and it was a bunch of MIT professors and stuff who decided they knew how to design the guidance system for intercontinental nuclear missiles. And they would do that in this big building, and they got venture capital to do it and stuff. It eventually became Tech Square is the name of that neighborhood now. And they got rid of those housing projects and stuff now. But anyway, so we started organizing these protests there. One of them was the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. And so we marched through the streets of Cambridge from City Hall. We actually got City Council to endorse it, the protest, which is really crazy. And we already called ourselves Food Not Bombs because of the idea that we're giving out food on one side of the streets to people that need it, and they're designing bombs on the other side. And it made sense to be call ourselves Food Not Bombs. So we had these series of marches on like Hiroshima Day, August 6th. And at that time, I brought like a phone book. Back then, they had phone books of all the names of all the people who lived in a town. And isn't that funny? And so I had this phone book soaked in gas. And I said, look, at if the Soviet Union sends a missile over here to Boston, it'll kill all these people just like this. And I lit the book on fire, and all the names, of course, burned up. And it was like quite dramatic. And we ended up doing a whole series of marches to Draper Lab with City Hall supporting it. And then the final thing that really became kind of what we think of as Food Not Bombs now is we realized that the Bank of Boston's board members were on the same were the same as the board members of the Public Service Company of New Hampshire, which was ordering a nuclear power station to be built in Seabrook, and that they were on the board of directors of Babcock and Wilcox, which was going to design the nuclear power station and still does to this day, and that they were on the board of the construction company and the concrete company and all this stuff, and on Lockheed Martin's board and on Raytheon's board. So we were like, wow, that's a lot like how in the roaring 20s the bankers would lend themselves money without oversight, and just like, and then they bankrupt the whole country and went into a depression. So we thought, wow, why don't we take some of the food I'm taking to the projects, we'll make it into soup, we'll dress up as hobos, we'll go down to the stockholders meeting, tell people, hey, you know, if you keep doing this, you know, the Americans might have to stand in line to eat at a soup kitchen. And we went, there was very few homeless people in Boston at that time, but there was a lot of vets, about maybe 30, 40 vets or so, maybe as many as 70, that periodically stayed at the Pine Street Inn, on this little street, Pine Street in South End. And so I went there at midnight, gave a little speech to the guys about the protest, and they were like so into it. And they're like, oh, protest like the 60s, that's so cool. And so they showed up the next day, and at the end of the meal, they're saying, you know, there's no meals here for people living at the Pine Street Inn. We have no way to get food. If you did this every day, it would be great. So that night, we had a meeting. We decided, wow, this was the coolest possible thing. So we end up giving, I gave 2 weeks' notice. And asked to still collect the food, so I did. And we set up a whole route in our little smooth move van all over the Boston area, picking up produce and bread and muffins and stuff like that. It was like, and then in the afternoons we would do deliveries to the housing projects and to Rosie's place. In 1981, Rosie's place was actually considered, I think, quasi illegal, because in Massachusetts still, women were still the property of their men. So battered women, if they escaped, you know, and went to the shelter, you know, could be arrested and sent home to their husbands. And so we had to be super secretive and make sure no one would find it. And we met them on street corners. It was like this weirdly clandestine thing. And we did a couple of other things. We took food to the Mohawk Nation at that time in that van, and we pretended like we were tourists because the New York City or New York State police were guarding the reservation to keep people from, they're trying to starve them out because they were saying, we're an independent nation, we have the right to tax tobacco and things our own, and you got to leave us alone. This is before the sovereignty got kind of resolved in many cases, although Nixon had given some land back to, say, the Dene and to the Pueblo and Taos and stuff like that, but still a lot of reservations were fighting for their legal rights. And so we supported them, and we also did these huge marches in the Pentagon. We sailed food on the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace ship. We sailed it up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and fed about 5,000 people in a park. That was amazing. Stuff like that. So that's kind of how the beginning. It was very relatively low-key. We did the first concert we did was on, I think, May 3rd, called Free Concert for Nuclear Disarmament on May 3rd, 1981. And we got half the bands were African-American and half were white. And we did it right on the border between the two communities in this park. And we made a deal with the city that we would police it, that they could ask them not to bring any police. And they ended up agreeing, and that was a pretty amazing experience. So, you know, that's that first little group, we rented a house, 195 Harvard Street. It was really eight of us, but before long it grew into about 30 people living in this house, people that just met us on the street and came home with us. And
hey, you mentioned this concert. Tell me more about connections with the music world. I'm particularly interested, as I mentioned to you, the connections between Food Not Bomb and punk rock and anarchy, anarchist communities. I know that a lot of bands have played benefit concerts for Food Not Bombs over the years and dedicated albums to Food Not Bombs. Dave Dichter from MDC has done stuff for Food Not Bombs. Good Riddance dedicated an album to Food Not Bombs and gave, you know, some of the proceeds from the album. Even Punk Voter, I once talked to Scott there, and he talked about connections with Food Not Bombs. Tell me about the connection between Food Not Bombs and the punk rock world.
So, yeah, at the beginning, we didn't really... Punk rock was mostly in Europe and England at that time. But so we were going to our friends saying, look, we need to have punk bands because we need to have like our own DIY idea because we want to do everything DIY. And that's when DIY became a term. It was like in 78, 79. So by the time we're doing Food Not Bombs, we're like, with all of our political organizing, we say we need our own music, like the same idea as rock music was for the protest movement in the 60s. We need to do our own thing, but we also need to keep it away from corporate control, because that we want that to be the main message of what we're trying to get across, you know. So we actually organized a few concerts at this place called the Ratskeller, which became a famous punk club in Boston, in Kenmore Square. And then also, I was friends with this other guy, Jeff. God, what's Jeff's last name? I forget Jeff's last name. But he was into punk also, so I started helping him with a magazine, a punk magazine called Platform News. And he was a graphic designer, and I was a graphic designer, and I bought my typesetting through him because he had more resources, so he had a typesetting machine. And so I first, in that magazine, I did a lot of illustrations, but I also wrote a natural history section in the magazine. We're trying to make a punk aesthetic, too, like artwork that was punk. We had people doing punk fashion, punk jewelry, punk hats. We're trying, and our idea was that we would just have this whole, for Food Not Bombs, so it would fit into this entire new vision where it was everything. It was art and music and culture and food and anarchism was the basic principle. And it was kind of crazy at that time because the communists were still super powerful in the alternative community. And they kind of were always banishing us to the sidelines of the big rallies and stuff because, you know, the Communist Party USA still was around, Workers World Party, all those kind of parties were still really pretty active, Revolutionary Communist Party, which were the only people that, of the communists that kind of connected with us because they were into the idea of maybe, the book Art and Revolution by Mao was an influence in a lot of us that were artists and into revolution. And RCP was Maoist, so they also could kind of relate to what we're doing. And largely the communist art was real ugly and like not really anything. And so usually Helvetica was the typeface they used for everything and stuff like that. So we're like, no, you know, forget that. So we're trying to create our own thing because we figure, well, young people won't want to be into social revolution if it's not got our own music, with our own lyrics that are anti-capitalist and that would all fit together. And so, and we did have other folk musics, like there were folk musicians that played at that concert. They're sort of like, I would say Gil Scott-Heron, you know, rip-off type young, people that ultimately become rap, you know, and, stuff like that at these free concerts. And then ones that we did benefits for. So, like, we had all these series of benefits at the Ratskeller and did that whole kind of thing. And before long, that neighborhood became really a punk neighborhood, Kenmore Square. And, that's where the Red Sox have Fenway Park and all that stuff. And, my little series of natural history, I really liked doing that. So I would investigate, like, I would do one on birds. So I did pigeons. And then I wrote all about the life of the pigeon and everything and how they were up until recently, they were the military, used them for communications, and they have this long history. And then I did one on cockroaches. I did one on concrete as a geological thing. I had like this tree called the tree of Judah, which is this kind of funny tree that the, back in Boston, the sea mariners brought it back from China in the 1700s to put it in the backyards. And by that time, that tree became a weed now. And it was actually so, had no predators, so it would just break the sides of freeways down. And they were like growing everywhere. It was like really cool. That whole like story about that and how the cockroach would survive. You know, nuclear war. So that was, you know, we're trying to do this whole funny thing with the punk scene, and we had like fashion sections of that. And so that was our idea, is that Food Not Bombs is going to be part of this whole larger DIY trip that we're trying to do, that would then ultimately we would everything would support each other, you know. That we're against war, we're against capitalism, we're against. In those days, there was the war in El Salvador. No one even knew about it. And we were like trying to get people to go, hey, man, we're killing all these people in El Salvador. We should protest that. At the same time, I like to remind people, too, that we're already working to stop climate change. That was already something that everybody knew, okay, this is going to be a disaster. We have to stop dealing with coal and all that stuff. And so there was already a movement about that, you know, and we were advocating solar power, and we were taking classes on that and trying to debunk the myth that that would never happen, and all kinds of, all those things were really interconnected, you know. And we did a lot of graffiti. I was very big on graffiti. I would cut these stencils. The most famous one was a drawing of a nuclear mushroom cloud. It said today, ? On next to it. And I did maybe 350, 400 of those images in Boston. And a play got written about it called Murder Now. And it won all these awards where they used that image for that. That inspired it was a play about these Armenian people that were going to using that logo. It was actually a Rastafarian guy supposedly spray painted. I took my mom to that play because she was featured. The mother of the graffiti artist was a big deal in the play. So I thought, oh, I got to take my mom to that. And then there's a movie made about that. So this whole idea of all these related things were really important, and I never really played music myself, but I did a ton of posters, and it turned out that was hugely influential because all these bands had in their liner notes stuff about Food Not Bombs, and we were in Profane Existence a ton of times, and that inspired like even a group to start in Poznan, Poland, where this guy Christoph read an article because he's subscribed to that, and it's still to this day. I have to say, I did a punk tour with two bands all over Mexico in like 2005, and that really started a huge scene in the Food Not Bombs movement down there. And I just went to a bunch of punk concerts in the Philippines, and a lot of the Food Not Bombs activists are actually band members. So like Bad Brains was a punk Food Not Bombs house band. Avail started Richmond Food Not Bombs. Let's see what else. Fugazi was the DC house band along with Bad Brains. They played a concert in Dolores Park where over 20,000 people showed up. It's like it became called Soup Stock. And we gave out food to all these people in Dolores Park. It was huge. And of course, MDC did tons of concerts for us. There was a kind of a punk folk album that was a compilation of bands from the Bay Area that was a benefit for Food Not Bombs. There was another punk album in New Jersey that was an LP that was done. Michael Franti had a whole section in the liner notes about Food Not Bombs on one of his albums. So it's had a big connection, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, nice connection back and forth with those realms.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It really helped us be global. And I have met people, all, you know, I go to some place and they go, oh, yeah, so-and-so band talked about you, and that's why I do Food on Bombs.
Yeah, great. I'm speaking with Keith McHenry this evening, and he will be in Santa Cruz for at least another day. You'll be able to see him tomorrow night at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. It's at 7 o'clock, 601 Ocean Street, Resource Center for Nonviolence. Tell me about the first time that you were arrested for offering food for free. And I don't know if this was that time.
Yeah, this picture that's here, which I don't know where that is. That's on the Food Not Bombs website, I guess, or something. Yeah. So, I was, as you can see in this photo, for the listeners who cannot see it, a riot officer is taking me away, and I have this little band on my arm, a little white band, and what that signifies is I just had a ruptured appendix 7 days before. And so I had just gotten out of the hospital, and I happened to be at a hospital just down the street from Golden Gate Park. And that Wednesday, so this is a Monday, so the Wednesday before, John and Derek, two of the volunteers, were borrowing my truck since I was recovering, doing the food pickups, and John got arrested for driving a he had a Maryland driver's license, but he was driving a truck with California plates, which allegedly was illegal. I don't know if that really is true or not, but anyway, they jailed him, and it was this whole huge ordeal. And that was the first we started getting an idea that maybe there's something going to happen. And there were some of these rumors. So I went down there to see what was going to happen, and I brought a camera. I was going to take pictures, but I never got to take any pictures because I got arrested immediately. And they arrested 9 of us. That's on August 15th, 1988. And that cop, when he was putting me in the cruiser, the people were running up going, "He just got out of the hospital," and he lifted my shirt, and I have all that bandage on there, and he goes, "Oh, shit." And it was like they were supposed to beat me up or something, and they couldn't do it because I had, might have killed me. So they just held us like about 14 hours or something like that, 15 hours. And the other picture, you can see some of the other, there's another picture that shows the riot police guarding the food, which is the photo that was in the San Francisco paper and in the Chronicle. And that photo flipped out people. They started coming to, they called us up the next day wanting to know if they could get arrested with us. And I don't know, people might know David Solnit. He did a lot of cool, he's still doing a lot of great things. I just ran into him in D.C. at that no spying protest, and he made all the banners for it and stuff. He's still doing kind of art and revolution. And so he made the poster for the next Monday's protest, and about 150 people showed up. We had a thing where you bang pots and with a spoon and march down the street. And then they arrested 27 people on that day. And that's when CNN showed up and filmed it. They got all over the world. That's probably the last time we had world news like that. And then we also, London Times, the New York Times, the Times of India, CBS, ABC, NBC, all these people, showed riot police arresting 27 people for feeding the hungry. And that freaked out the police, so they tried a technique the next week. They said, "Oh, we don't mind they're feeding people, but that they're making a political statement, and that's not allowed. And what we'll do is we'll get buses. The homeless can go out to the ocean, to an armory. You can feed them inside there, but you can't be outside with literature and a banner and stuff like that, because that would be crazy." And then the media talked to us, and we said, "Well, look, we're trying to change society, because just 8 years before, there were almost no homeless people. And now with 8 years of Ronald Reagan and the MX missile and the Star Wars and all the stuff that he's spending all this money on, and he's cutting all these other programs, you know, now you look at it, you got all these people living in the streets. It's like crazy." And that, I think, is a really important point to make, because, you know, most people assume that there's been millions of homeless Americans all the time, you know. But that actually, there was a whole time between, at the end of the Great Depression, when World War II started, from all through World War II up until 1988, there was very few homeless Americans. You know, you'd have them at the Bowery, and, there's these homeless dudes at the Bowery that would wipe your windshield with their greasy rags, and then you'd have to pull over and find soap and wash your windshield and stuff. You couldn't see it all. But the idea was that they're really super drunk, and they're just trying to give you money not to wash the windshield because you knew you wouldn't be able to see. And with that Bowery down in the, Lower East Side in Manhattan. But otherwise, you didn't really see, like, you know, I saw a few people in the South End, that were homeless, that were just basically so drunk, it was just crazy. But it wasn't like now, where it's whole families living on the streets, and it's all from the economic collapse, you know.
You've just mentioned a couple of things that I was hoping to talk with you about. One is spying, the NSA, and police. And I know that you've written quite a bit about police surveillance, police infiltration, all of that, and experienced it yourself. And now, I mean, there's practically every day pretty huge revelations about the extent to which the NSA and police are spying on us. That's one thing I wanted to talk to you about. Well, I can't remember the other thing right now.
Well, anyway, on the issue of the spine, I think the fact that Snowden has released these things and then all these other whistleblowers have come forward has been really positive, because now the idea of there being domestic surveillance is now kind of like, oh, yeah, there's domestic surveillance. However, the hurdle to overcome with that is that it's assumed, okay, well, we're all being spied on. We don't have anything to hide, but it's just this kind of vague infringement on our rights, and you have that open letter that was just put out by Apple and Google and stuff calling for targeted surveillance. Well, that's one of the things that's a big problem is targeted surveillance, because, you know, those of us that are actually trying to change society are the targets of that surveillance, and so in this all this miles of information about spying, I have not yet heard hardly anything except for in the most marginal areas of the media saying, well, look at no, all these regular Americans who are legally allowed to do what they're doing, that are trying to critique the way society is happening, are targeted, and their lives are made really difficult, and their effort to change society is interfered with. And so I was working on a book about this before Snowden, and now I've kind of had to rethink the whole thing, because a number of other things happened, like Jeremy Hamden leaked, he got framed for this. It was part of a larger counterintelligence operation by the FBI to try to bust Anonymous, but he was given the password to the Stratford files, and Jeremy is a Food Not Bombs activist from Chicago, and he got 10 years in prison for this, and they were kind of threatening him with stuff so, like treason, that he might get life in prison, so he settled for 10, and but the thing that he got was this other combination of files on how the corporations, which was part of my other book, because one of the things I noticed up until Snowden was that you'd see a book like by Ward Churchill and all these different people that about the FBI and what they did to AIM and the Panthers and stuff. And then it would be like, oh, okay, that ended at the end of with the Frank Church Commission and so on. Now there's no more spying. It's all cool. And then 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden there was spying. But it was all justified because of 9/11, and it was all about terrorists, except for Food Not Bombs activists were being jacked up all the way between the end of the Church Commission all the way to, like, well, you know, a couple of years after the Church Commission. So from 1980 on, so I have like 32 envelopes opened, said damaged in mail, you know, sorry, you know, for the problem, and put in a plastic bag, an official bag from the U.S. Post Office, and they were all soaked in coffee on the stamp end of the letter. And it turned out of all the mail that came, these were the only 32 letters that were checks for donations to Food Not Bombs. And this was in like 1980 and 81. To a private mailbox that we rented in Harvard Square. So we were already having that at that time. We were also connected to the, you know, we're working against the war in Central America, and the FBI broke into old Cabimarus Baptist Church, and we just gotten the newest little IBM computers and had made our little, you know, mailing list on it. We're all excited about that. And what gets stolen? Just the computers and stuff that actually was much more valuable just left behind. And then an actual Boston Globe journalist became really interested in that. He wrote a whole book on FBI surveillance against the Central American activist community and stuff, the people protesting in C-Space and Pledge Resistance and stuff. And so, you know, when you hear, I've even heard like, oh, what's his name? Like the guy from PBS, Bill Maher, or no, Moyer and company, to say that there was no surveillance, you know, up until 9/11. You know, I've actually quoted him in my book about that, because that's just such a common myth. And then the other myth is that it's the CIA. So there's whole books on how the CIA kills people and spies, or you have you know, Blackwater and that kind of thing, but you don't usually get, you don't get the connection that there's actually red squads in local police departments, is what they call them, or gang task force, and that there is this and there's a little more news coming out about these fusion centers. But there is all, even before the fusion center, you have the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which actually didn't go away, but they added the fusion center to it. And then you have all these other code names and stuff. So all along there's been these private like Chevron and Bank of America and Wells Fargo all have their private spy agencies, Exxon, all of them. And then they coordinate with city spy agencies, with also with state spy agencies, and with the federal government spy agencies, and with you know, the military spy agencies. And even though that's allegedly illegal for the military to spy on American people, but if it's the Fusion Center, they're allowed to. So the thing that's really happened is who knows? There's all kinds of things like climate change. We might not be today facing the crisis of climate change if this massive spy operation hadn't worked on behalf of Exxon and Chevron and BP and stuff to undermine activists trying to address the issue of climate change. Because it was known in the 70s that this was a major crisis. There were people working on it. But not only were the activist groups infiltrated, and it was targeted sometimes. Like, so, for instance, we know about Judy Bear and Daryl Turney, how the FBI made these little fake Earth First flyers saying that they were going to kill people and put them around the logging places. Or so there's a climate change issue of the logging. You had other coal, you know, Black Mesa and Big Mountain and the whole thing in the Four Corners trying to stop that, and you know, and the Alberta tar sands, all these different things that people have been organizing around. But because they infiltrated the organizations, they pitted people against each other, they disrupted their meetings, they destroyed their financial support, things like that, they were kept change from happening, and a whole array of things like human rights. So like today when John Kerry is talking about how the you know, the Ukrainians should abide by, you know, don't send out riot police and harm the poor protesters, and, you know, it's in, you know, it's, or Obama's making the speech about respecting you know, the right to protest and all that, and before at the Mandela Memorial. It's total hypocrisy, because they're like completely have this major campaign. And then the fund for Partnership for Justice Fund released all that stuff about the infiltration and disruption and coordination by private security agencies against Occupy, which included suggesting that somebody out there might be organizing a campaign to use suppressed sniper rifles to assassinate the leadership of Occupy. But they never called any of the leaders up to say, oh, you know, there's like this group that's going to shoot you with a and kill you if you keep doing your Occupy, you know, and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's and then there's also media manipulation, efforts to, in the little food not bombs world, you have this whole crazy thing that happens. I keep running into people that say, oh, you know, like in Cincinnati recently, the police have been coming every week saying, you can do this as long as you don't have the banner and the literature. And they approach me saying, isn't it our First Amendment right to have banner and literature at these meals? But they're just hinting that what they do is they wait for you to have a tight relationship with the people you're feeding. The kind of, if you don't know about your First Amendment rights they develop this idea that you're a charity, you don't need to worry about this stuff, and then they convince you to get rid of the banner and the literature, then people don't talk about political ideas. They think you're a church, and now you don't want to harm your chances of feeding people you're close to, because you know they need the food no matter what. And so then you get rid of the banner and the literature. And you can see that Prescott, Arizona did that. You know, L.A. doesn't have banners of literature. Santa Monica has no banners of literature. They don't have it in Portland, Oregon. San Francisco hasn't had any banners and literature at their meals since 1997, which is where the first place where the idea was developed. Seattle. So it's like this very common now where the major Denver has no banner or literature, hasn't in decades. Tompkins Square Park only started bringing a banner recently. Another one is that they'll go, oh, hey, you could, if you change your name to Feed Santa Cruz, you'd feed a lot more people, because that name, Food Not Bombs, is so controversial, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the group will change their name to Feed whatever the town is, and they disappear after a few meals, and that's the end of it. So they have more subtle things besides the framing you on terrorism story that they also do.
It's really interesting. It's it seemed pretty clear to me over the years that the FBI, CIA, NSA, a lot of the larger organizations, not always local police, but the larger organizations are spending most of their time and energy and tools on disrupting democratic movements domestically than there's military organizations in the United States that are doing that abroad, disrupting democratic movements. I want to let you know that 3 months ago, the Santa Cruz City Council voted to pass a Justice Department grant of about $30,000 to the Santa Cruz Police to buy license plate readers.
Wow.
So that'll be the first time that technology is used here in a permanent way. I'm hoping that they change their minds. I'm doing a lot of research and writing a story about it for the Santa Cruz Good Times. So I've been interviewing the city council people, people from other cities that have these or almost had these and didn't want them. They're devices that take a picture of the license plate of all cars in a city or a given area. They also take simultaneously a photo of the whole car, including often the surrounding area, the people in or near the car, and many photos. Often in a span of about a year, maybe 100, 200, 300 photos of you and your car, creating potentially a map of where you go, who you hang out with, what you do. There's no overall rules, regulations, or laws about how to store the data, who has access to it, how long. Some police departments keep this stuff, and there's quite a few that have these already. Some keep the data forever.
Right. Well, I've heard that some can actually, like, just the numbers themselves can go into a computer from the video itself, and the software can then identify that car.
Yeah.
And they have a date stamp thing where it says, okay, that, and they have them just on poles and stuff all around town. So as your car goes around town, it says, you went here, you went here, you went here, you went here, and they can just go into the computer and download every place you went. They also, you know, like, I don't know if the Santa Cruz police have done this, but Verizon and all them will sell your town police software to track the location of all the cell phones in your town.
Yeah.
And they give you a little class on how to use the software and everything, and usually about $5,000 or $6,000. It's pretty cheap, really. So,
and there was an article in USA Today just 2 days ago on the cover saying, you know, something like, if you think you've been worried about the NSA, maybe you look at your local police. There's more sophisticated, similar devices that you just described, but more sophisticated and much more expensive, that kind of, what I understood was they mimic, and it's maybe the size of a briefcase, this device, it mimics a cell phone tower. And police agencies across the country are buying these things. And knowing via GPS where certain people are all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and monitoring. I was surprised, and I was arrested for the first arrest ever was in Portland, Oregon, and I was the superintendent of the Portland Art Museum, and it was just for nothing, really. But I got taken to the police headquarters, you know, to be put in jail, and they actually had video cameras in 1978 of all the parks in the whole city, and these huge banks of TV screens, and there were just people sitting there watching all the people in all the parks in Portland in 1978. So they were already doing stuff like that at that time. That's like really crazy. But there's so many levels of surveillance. Now, the thing is, like you know, listeners might be going, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, there's not going to be anything going to happen to you, right? But the problem is, if they figure out you don't like, say you're, this happened to people doing organic gardening in Manhattan. They figured that the Manhattan Institute did a white paper saying that it was leading to democratic thought, that people were actually coming out together to grow food and flowers and stuff in these vacant lots, and they're all, it was this cooperative thing of random citizens, and that this was a threat to town, to corporate power, and that they made sure all the little gardens were controlled by the city, and you had to get a city employee to open the door to let you in, the gate, and give you the little tools. And you, the city employee told you when and where to put what plants in and stuff. And that way, then it took away that threat of democratic process. But in doing that, they're like, we're spying on the all the figure out who the players were in the you know, in the organic gardening movement and Lower East Side in Manhattan, you know, so they've just like monitored. So it becomes, so what they can do is then they can, you know, they'll go, you know, say like if they're collecting your location. You could see this in movies like the kids that were busted with Brendan Darby, right? So you had an FBI informant, Brendan Darby, who joins Food on Bombs in Austin, Texas. He gains people's confidence because he's a big deal in Austin Food on Bombs. And then he meets these kids. They need to have somebody bomb something, or why are you hiring spies? So Brendan starts cultivating these two new people right out of high school from Midland, Odessa. Convinces them to tries to convince them to bomb something. It's totally unclear what they're allegedly going to throw a firebomb at the Republican National Convention. But he's got some suggestions. Maybe the big sign for the RNC, you know, little electric sign they had out in front of the convention center, or maybe a police vehicle, something. We could do something about that. But they use like the fact that they went into a hardware store and there was a receipt that they were in the hardware store buying this stuff that Brendan has suggested they buy, and there's video of them coming out of the stores. They've collected that. They collected a whole pattern trying to make it out like that they were the ones that are thinking of the plot, because they went to all these places and they took all. So after the fact, you may not be thinking you're doing anything wrong, but government suddenly decides that organic gardening is not a cool thing or whatever it is, and then suddenly all this data is used. And I used to have this problem in San Francisco. It happened to me a bunch of times where it turned out the police were filming me coming in and out of my house, so they'd know what I wore, and they were listening to everything I was saying in my house, and they were listening to my, or, you know, read my emails and listening to my phone. And so what they would do is they'd have somebody dressed like me that looked like me. So they had like three shifts of people that grew my same beard, had the same kind of build, and bought the same wardrobe. And so then a guy would do a crime like a block away from me. And then I would get, the police would rush around, grab me, pick me up, take me to jail for the crime. And then you'd find these witnesses that were like, oh yeah, I saw a guy in, you know, black pants and tennis shoes break out these windows, you know. And then I'm like, since I don't know what's going on because I never did any crimes, it's hard for me to combat, oh yeah, well he went over here and bought the magic markers and he bought this here and he did that there, because we all know all the places he went. And then that ties him, says, look, at just the last place he was getting a bagel at the shop. So then 10 minutes later, he's breaking out the windows over here. So then the jury's watching all this, and they've got half the witnesses are undercover cops that are like, you know, pretending like they're not connected to the police. But then they find, you know, if we uncover that, well, they go, still got two or three witnesses that we can't tie to the police who did see a guy do the crime. But the guy wasn't me, so it makes it really hard to fight against. And so they can do, you know, also other things with computers. There was a thing called the Tom Girard, Roy Bullock spy scandal, where they were inputting all these activists all over California. The job was to give you parking tickets remotely. And then you would end up, when you try to register your vehicle, you would have thousands of dollars worth of parking tickets, and you couldn't. I kept wondering why the chief of police and all these people were at parking in traffic when I went to pay my tickets. I thought, man, that's like a high-ranking bunch of guys standing around talking in the lobby of parking in traffic. And then I would, I had a way with Paul Bowden, and then to work off my hours, I'd work off my hours, and I'd get my affidavit, so my tickets were dealt with, and then I'd drive to DMV. And in the time it took me to drive from parking in traffic to Department of Motor Vehicles in the Hate, I would end up with $250 more parking tickets. While I'm driving, where I only stop for lights and traffic. And so then I have to go work off those hours, and I would do that maybe four or five times, where as fast as I could drive from parking in traffic to DMV, I'd get more tickets. Because it turned out there was some kind of little thing that alerted Tom Girard to the fact that I was just got my affidavit, so he could quickly start typing in tickets for me. And now I'm sure they have just computer programs that do it. With, they don't even need to have a guy in a houseboat in Sausalito to do it. But I found I have like 750 pages of documents. And then you talk about, we haven't talked about Mandela or anything, but anyway, the South African secret police were trying to stop apartheid and stuff, and these people were selling information about what my traveling around town and my activism and many other activists in town to the South African secret police and stuff like that, you know. So, you know, it's interesting. And Israeli Mossad and, you know, like all the different agencies in Britain and stuff. And they would meet in motels in downtown San Francisco. And this guy, Cal Bullock, would give them all this stuff about what they saw all these activists doing to these foreign governments. And it was like really, and that's all like so. By now, it's like really super complicated. And then they would get, you know, you have, you know, like, infighting at you know, in meetings and all these different things that are going on. But the thing is not to be so paranoid, is to set up systems where you like the most common thing is a joking about bombings. And you don't know whether people are joking or suggesting it. And you get that at a meeting, you know, you've got like to shut that down, because that joking about bombing, which has happened to at meetings I've been to for 40 years now, always leads to no good. And you know, so and saying that it's, you know, we have to bomb things, and you can't tell, like that's what happened with the RNC8. And there was a woman at my age who just got divorced and all this stuff. She comes to the meetings and she hates George Bush, she loves dumpster diving, and she starts joking about bombings. Mm. And they take the transcript of her jokes and these other informants' jokes, and they type it up. They don't really attribute it to the informant that's saying it. They just say it's said at the meeting. Mm. And then they, the judge went, oh, my God, they're talking about that at the meeting? We better give you the warrant you want. And then they raid the Funabombs house and arrest everybody. So just a second, even though to the Funabombs kids, they're like, who's this, like, a lady, like, joking about bombing? That doesn't make any sense. But no one, everyone's shy. They don't know what's up about it, so they just let it slide. And it becomes the basis for them facing terrorism charges, you know. So, yeah, isn't that crazy? So all these techniques are over and over and over again.
And I know you've written about having been taken off of an airplane by Homeland Security, too, or not allowed to fly on an airplane. Is that true?
Yeah, well, on one case, I went to visit Turkey and hang out with people there, and I came back, and I went from Heathrow, you know, Turkey, Heathrow, to Chicago, and they made this little announcement, you know, about welcome to Chicago, stay in your seat, the whole normal little thing. And then, all of a sudden, the guy that said that, you could hear his voice was, like, really nervous. He goes, oh, you must show your passport when you exit the plane onto the jetway. So I'm not thinking anything of it, and I exit the plane, and they go, oh, come with us, Mr. McHenry. And so we go, and they have the suitcases at the carousel, and they stand next to me, say, when you get your suitcases, follow us. And then we have to follow them into this big, giant room, and they say, how are you involved in the violent group Food Not Bombs? What's your role in the violent group Food Not Bombs? And then they take everything out of my wallet and input it into a computer. And while they're, and they came across the ACLU business card, and the lady goes, what's this ACLU business card? And stuff like that. And meanwhile, a guy in a coat and tie, a sports coat and a tie, is sitting on a high stool behind the monitor that this woman is inputting everything into. And he's going, what about that fire in Alpine, Arizona? Wasn't that a great fire? You know, and then I'm in Chicago here, and this guy's going, yeah, and then there was that other really big fire, and that was really big, wasn't it? And he keeps going, like we're old buddies in the firefighting business or something in Arizona. I'm just thinking, what a weird thing. And he just kept, so it was only, you know, it's just like, no, he was never introduced. It was like not known why this man is talking about forest fires for like an hour. You know, while the woman's, like, typing in all my credit cards and everything into a computer. It was weird. And then at some point they said, okay, you can go now. And then that was it.
Crazy.
I also got pulled out of my vehicle on the way into Vermont at gunpoint. And they were like, put your hands on the wheel, put your hands on the wheel. And then they made me get out of my van with my hands on my head and took me at gunpoint into this room yelling at me the whole time that I had to keep my back, walk backwards, you know. And then I get in this room, keep your back to the door, keep your back to the door. And they like hold me there for a while. And then eventually they let me go. And I say, here, you got to sign this thing saying no, you don't have any fruit. So I sign this thing saying don't have any fruit. And they go, man, you got a great old van there. We haven't seen one of those in years. That's really cool. And then let me go. But then as soon as I got into the country, into the U.S., I went to change my money at this exchange place. And I leave that, and the Border Patrol pulled me over. And he's like, oh, yeah, we never seen anybody go there to get money. That seems really suspicious. I'm like, what are you talking about? That's, like, weird, man. So, stuff like that. Wow. A lot of crazy things happen, for sure. Yeah, so it's not uncommon. And then I got in trouble. I've had people tell me they were coming into the U.S. from Mexico, and they had a Funabomb's bumper sticker on their car, and this one woman in a band had her children. They took her children to a room and said, look, at you know, we see you got this Funabomb's bumper sticker here. You know, you can't come into the U.S. And threatened to take the kids and stuff. And then eventually they said, okay, if you scrape the bumper sticker off, you can come into America. Wow. Stuff like that.
So what do you think, how the impact from food not bombs can be measured in different ways? I mean, sometimes I've been in activist groups and we think, wow, if they're not coming down on us, we must not be doing very well. I don't necessarily like that measurement. what are other ways that you measure the success of Food Not Bombs over the years?
Oh, well, you know, you get like, one is you go from 8 college students with no money to being in 1,000 cities of the world. That's one measurement. Visiting the Food Not Bombs chapters and seeing all these miraculous things they invent, you know, like the really, really free markets that Christchurch, New Zealand Food Not Bombs invented, what Heather Flores did with Food Not Lawns that just starts taking off everywhere, stuff like that. So that's another measurement, all these spin-off concepts. Then also just the fact that stuff that was hidden, like, you know, the WTO and stuff like that, Food Not Bomb's role in helping make that something public that people know about. The other one is the current wave of clampdowns on Food Not Bombs. That's sort of like the original measurement you're referring to, and we're currently being, like, there was just an interesting thing. The kids in Seattle showed me this article, front page article of the Seattle Weekly. Talks about all the wonderful food, like Salvation Army and everything like that. But it has this whole section about how somebody donated baked potatoes and tin foil to Food Not Bombs, and it was horrible, and somebody could have been sick, and blah, blah, blah. And there you could see it was a setup for this. It's one of a series of recent articles about trying to stop Seattle Food Not Bombs. And then you have, it also is not limited to Food Not Bombs, though. They can throw in some repression against churches that share food outside in public. And I do think, though, that the massive amount of cities like Sacramento just got bothered. I just was given a bunch of papers by the lawyer in that case. He got in Public Records Act request, which I haven't read, but he said I'll be very interested in reading them, so I hope to read them. I just got them last night. And so there's apparently like a nationwide campaign against the sharing of food in public. And so that there's a concern that somehow these public meals may lead to something. Now, they just had a report that they're going to... It turned out Congress was unable to continue unemployment benefits for nearly 2 million Americans. So there's 2 million people going to really be poor. They're cutting food stamps. And this whole sequester thing that just got resolved, some people are indicating that that's going to be a total crazy thing. You know, it's going to be really out there. So we just don't know what's going to happen with that. Then... So I think that there needs to be some major organizing around that. Also, there's this new law. I just called up the city councilors down in L.A. They're introducing a law, which is right now before the both the Public Works Committee and the Gang Prevention task force of the city council. Somehow they're thinking we're like a some way related to gangs or something, and so they're going to try to ban or limit the sharing of food in public in Los Angeles. And you already have that in Philadelphia, you have that in Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, Dayton, Ohio, all this, every major city in Florida. So it's becoming like a pretty major trip that's all over the country. So one thing I found was interesting, I happened to see this video twice on C-SPAN of a lecture of State Department official in April of 2009 talked about how there was... comparing the people that share the vegan meals in the parks and Al-Qaeda, who's more dangerous. And they conclude by saying that the vegan meals are more dangerous because influencing the American public to think money should be diverted from military spending towards education, healthcare, and other social services. And I saw that show twice, that lecture twice on C-SPAN. And if I hadn't, I would have probably thought it was hallucinating. But that shows that basically the central idea of what Food Not Bombs is doing, having this impact of people knowing you can actually eat there, that the food is good, that we have the literature and banners, and that you come across the meal as a general person in public not knowing these ideas, and you're moved by it to either join Food Not Bombs or to feel that, wow, you know, if these people with no money can feed all these people, then how come the government is letting the people starve? And it brings up the question, why do we have all these people living in our streets and needing food from places like Food Not Bombs when we can have all this money for weapon systems? And they just increased the military budget today by billions of dollars in this new Ryan bill thing that they just agreed to, that all the Democrats and Republicans says is a great deal and we're going to do it, except for the Republicans are complaining there's no deep enough cuts in Social Security and Medicare. You know, you're just like, whoa. And like, what war is it that we're supposed to fight, and why do we need extra bombs? But then the criminalization of the police, I don't know if you've been hearing about that Lopez, is that his name? I forget his name, in Sonoma that got shot. He was like a 13-year-old boy, and the police shot him to death with, and so they've been sending, there was a protest at city council there and yesterday, and they brought snipers to the protest, like, and it was 11 and 12-year-old middle school kids and stuff like that, and riot police, and beat people up and injured a few people and jailed some of the kids. And so the militarization of the police, so like you're seeing about this program for Santa Cruz, they're also, I've been seeing as I drive around North America, these flatbed trucks with those big, giant sand-colored armored personnel vehicles with the giant, super giant wheel, rubber tires with machine gun turrets on the top and stuff that can fit all these soldiers inside. And it's got like places to shoot out the from the windows, like little turrets, like little mobile forts, you know, big mobile forts. I mean, they're almost like, you know, as tall as a semi-truck. And they're giving those to local police all over America. And then they have SWAT teams all over America. You can see that all the time where a bunch of, I'm sure Santa Cruz has that, like has like 50 guys that are sitting in some room right now with all their military helmets and flak jackets and all these weapons and stuff ready to rush out there in case something happens. And so the whole country has gone into this, like, and they're passing laws making that more possible and more reasons for it and checkpoints everywhere and all this crazy stuff, so that it's and I heard that Jerry Brown's into a bunch of that stuff, trying to promote all that kind of thing. And he's supposed to be our liberal, you know, governor. And it's, you know, when I came to Sacramento, I was on the way in. I was talking about spending $13 billion on some water diversion project, and he's going to spend more money on this, more cops and these things. I'm just like, wow, whatever happened to Moonbeam and that whole thing, you know? And it's just like funny, isn't it? Like, so the whole country's going, or like how they keep shooting, like in Taos, they end up shooting up this tourist van with their kids in it during a traffic stop, you know? They're always shooting first now and asking questions later. And that seems to be a national policy, like the national policy to shut Food Not Bombs down. And the national policy to drive all the homeless out of sight, mm-hmm. and the national policy to criminalize everybody for absolutely mm-hmm. everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a
scary time and an exciting time in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Definitely, the country is being militarized. The police are being militarized. It's just such an odd situation where there's people who are hungry, and to feed them, it's illegal. That's always just boggled my mind. I remember encountering Noam Chomsky's ideas about something you were touching on. The healthcare debates around serving people through education, healthcare, meeting people's needs. The debates really aren't about the details of how to do that in this country. What Chomsky was pointing out was that actually what government is wanting is that people don't care about each other.
Right.
There's my sense is that there's kind of an inherent compassionate quality to human beings that happens for a variety of reasons, and it actually takes quite a bit to bash that out of people and have them not care about even people they know, let alone not care about strangers.
Right.
In our country, a lot of that caring and compassion has been connected to what we've been told are evil political systems, socialism, communism. Those are systems that are based on contribution, connection, compassion. Here, you can have medical care and be successful and contribute if you work hard.
Right. Theoretically, right? Yeah.
Well, that's the propaganda.
Correct.
Around it. So it's hugely unsettling to be part of a political, economic, philosophical education structure that condemns compassion.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, but I think you're right. On the other hand, I think one of the reasons of the militarization and all the propaganda against it, and even these reality TV shows and stuff where you're and Rush Limbaugh type radio programs and stuff where you have to hate each other and there's just everything's a fight and you have to